just to make sure everyone gets in before I start, I'll go ahead and just start real quickly. That's a bit loud. As most of you know, I'm filling for Rick. He is at the Brown Trail School of Preaching Lectures, speaking, I think, later this afternoon. So that's why I'm up here right now instead of him. I'm pretty sure if he was here, he'd say that you guys would most likely be delighted to get to not have to listen to his drawling voice. I don't know if you guys are going to enjoy listening to me. When my mom came in, she had told me that one of Joe's friends, Jacob Caldwell, Friday night had been shot in the face. They had said it's not life-threatening. Just go ahead and keep him in your prayers. Once again, Jacob Caldwell, him and my younger brother have been friends for as long as I can remember. So it's one of those friendships that it's a keeper. I believe Wednesday he had left off with the Chronicles. So I'm going to start with 1st and 2nd Chronicles. I'm not going to really hit all that much on the Chronicles that much. I'm basically going to point out how they're like the books, 1st and 2nd Kings, and how they're different. Moreover, I'm going to spend more time really talking about Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther. And before that, I'm actually going to kind of, just for me, one thing I always remember from school is Brother Curtis Cates and even his son saying that half the battle of understanding any book is a proper introduction. So I'm going to kind of go to the minor prophets and go to the major prophets and show through those exactly why we have Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, why the Jews actually went into captivity. It is my firm belief that had God's people obeyed him like they should have, that the Old Testament would be less books than it was. Because if you look at it, most of the Old Testament is the major and the minor prophets. And much of what the major and the minor prophets are doing is telling God's people and then also telling the nations, get right or God's judgment will come upon you. So I'm submitting it to you, and this is just my opinion, that had the world obeyed God as they simply should have, that we would not have Isaiah through Malachi. But so real quick, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, if you were to read through both books, you would read much of the same stuff that you read in 1st and 2nd Kings. The only major difference is being that 1st and 2nd Chronicles kind of zoom in on Judah. And then instead of just being an overview of Judah, they kind of zoom in even closer and they kind of hit Judah's history pertaining to how it affected the priesthood, how it affected the temple, so on and so forth. 1st and 2nd Chronicles, you could really say, is Israel's history from David to the last king, which, if I'm correct, I'm not for certain, don't quote me on this, but I believe it was Manasseh or someone right after Manasseh. But it basically is a priest's view of Judah's history. So you see a lot of talk about the temple. You see a lot of kings that they have another name that's used in the book of Chronicles. And if you don't completely understand kings and when they reigned and who reigned before them and after them, the different name might confuse you, because you're like, well, wait, I thought that this king reigned after this king, when they're just giving another name. For instance, one good example is King Uzziah. I don't remember what he's called in 1 Kings, or in 2 Kings, in the Kings at the moment, but he was the king that went into the temple and did something God didn't like, and that God basically smote him with leprosy. So that's just one small example, is that 1st and 2nd Chronicles focus on Judah. You really do not see anything of the nation of Israel, except for when they either attacked or when they had some dealing with Judah. And then you don't see much besides... I'm sorry, I'm going blank. I haven't taught class in a while, as you can tell, so I'm rusty. It really focuses on the temple. It really focuses on Judah and its relationship with God. And in the end, it shows you partially why Judah was still taken away, is in that they went the way of Israel. They had their good kings. They had King David. They had their other good kings. But for the most part, they were just as wicked, if not even more wicked than Israel. Now, quickly, go ahead and go to the very last chapter of 2 Chronicles. Okay, go to the very last verses of 2 Chronicles. Notice particularly 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verses 22 and 23. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord spoken by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and put it also in writing, saying, Thus saith Cyrus, king of Persia, all the kingdoms of the earth hath the Lord God of heaven given me, and he hath charged me to build him an house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Who is there among you of all his people? The Lord his God be with him, and let him go up. So that is the very last verses of 2 Chronicles. If someone wouldn't mind reading about the first three verses of Ezra. Thank you. So, 2 Chronicles 36, 22, and 23 is almost word for word what Ezra writes in the first three verses of Ezra chapter 1. That's important why it's put there twice, because if you wouldn't mind, go ahead and go to Isaiah with me. Go to Isaiah. And if I'm correct, it should be chapter 45. Isaiah chapter 45. And go ahead and notice verse 1. Isaiah 45 and verse 1. Thus says the Lord to his anointed, to who? To Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two-leaved gates, and the gate shall not be shut. I will go before thee and make the crooked places straight. I will break in pieces the gates of brass and cut in sunder the bars of iron. And I will give thee the treasures of darkness and hidden riches of secret places, that thou mayest know that I, the Lord, which call thee by thy name, am the God of Israel. For Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by thy name. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. There is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me. Does anyone know how long Isaiah wrote before the birth of Cyrus? 150 years. 150 years before Cyrus was alive, before Cyrus was even, in the way I've heard it put, before Cyrus was even a speckle in his father's eye, Isaiah, by inspiration of God, had already told him what he was going to do and how he was important. And then later on, you see it come to fruition. That is why it is written twice that it was Cyrus who made the proclamation for Israel to return to their home and to build the temple. That is why you see it written there twice. Now, it could be that 1st and 2nd Chronicles, or at least 2nd Chronicles, was written by Ezra, and then also that he wrote the book of Ezra itself. But that's why you see the last two verses and then the first two verses. And then as Rick has already said, when it came to the Hebrew scribes that were writing the Old Testament, they always wanted to make the book that was ending and the book that was coming before it, or coming after it, they wanted to make sure they tied in somehow. Normally they did this by, I don't remember what it's called, but it was a little mark that they would use, or that was in the Hebrew language, and that was normally at the start of every new book that they were writing. And basically, what that mark showed, or what it meant in Hebrew, was that this was a continuation. Kind of how you can think of how at the end of certain TV shows, if they have two episodes that are going to mesh together, or that there's going to be a second part, it says to be continued. The little mark that the Hebrew scribe would use when they would put that was basically saying to be continued, and then it was continued in the next book. But that is why that was put, and then why it was reiterated, is because it is tying 1st and 2nd Chronicles to Ezra, and then of course tying Ezra to Nehemiah and Nehemiah to Esther. Now, as Rick had said, when you look at it, you have Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Genesis and Exodus bring forward time. You come to Leviticus, there isn't any time that moves. And you see that going, as he had said, when it comes to Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, Ezra brings us forth a certain amount of time. Nehemiah brings us about a certain amount of time. And then you come to Esther, and she doesn't really take you forward any more time. She talks of a different time, but it basically, as he said, fits into about, I believe, Ezra, in between Ezra 6 and 7, or somewhere in there. And that's important for us, because when you look at Esther, you see, in the first chapter, you see one king. And then in the next chapter, in chapter 2, you see another king. But they're the same king. It's because in between Esther chapters 1 and Esther chapter 2, there is so much history that took place that king basically, you could say, was humbled in a fashion. And a lot of that has to do with Persia fighting with Greece, and Greece destroying them. Has to do with what is known as the intertestamental period. So if that sounds something that's like intriguing to you, you might want to pick up a book or something that has to do with the intertestamental period, or just pick up Greece history. But so we can't get into it that deeply. But so, Ezra brings us forward to a certain time. Nehemiah takes us from that point to another time. And then we hit Esther and we kind of jump back a bit. So we don't progress forward any time in Esther. We kind of, you could say, jump back. Now, before we get any further into that, what is the main reason, or what are some of the main reasons that Judah, you could say Judah and Israel, went into captivity? They went away from God, yes. I mean, you can look at 2 Kings chapter 18, and it really does kind of lift off for you all the stuff that they did. But of course, then again, that's only a small amount of what they did. And then really, when did Israel start that cycle that they just kept on following in? How they were with God, and then they would go away from God, and then they would get into trouble, and then they would call for God's help, and then God would come and rescue them, and then they'd be excited, and they'd come back to God, and then they would leave God again, and then he would put them into punishment. And then they would call for him. When did that happen? When did that cycle start? Close, but it was actually before the judges. It started before they crossed the sea. If you think of it, and you have to look at it in this way. If you live in a society for a long enough time and you see them doing things, what are you going to do? After a while, it's just going to become second nature to you. Now, what was the thing with Egypt? They, much like many of the nations back then, they had a god for everything. When it came to the Egyptians, the Nile was their god. The grass was their god. They had the god of the dead, the god of the Nile, the god of this, the god of that. So they were surrounded by polytheism, by many gods. They had seen, and they had, a lot of them had grown up in believing in multiple gods and worshiping multiple gods and worshiping them each in their own way. They had also grown up in, and I think I'm safe in saying this, that if something bad happened, oh, we have upset the gods, we have angered the gods, we need to appease the gods. So they were, you could say, brought up in that mindset. So it started then, but you'd think that after they came out of Egypt that that would have gone away. But I think you could say it was so deeply ingrained in them that when they had the first chance, like when I had said the other day, when they did not have a leader that was there that was strong enough to keep them faithful, it fell through. Go to Exodus 32. Go to Exodus chapter 32. That's really when you could say that the cycle started for Israel where they started it themselves. Go to Exodus chapter 32. And just start right at verse 1. Exodus chapter 32 and verse 1. And when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we know not what has become of him. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, of your sons, and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people brake off the golden earrings which were in their ears, and brought them unto him. You continue to read on. They make the golden calf, and the very foolish statement is made by Aaron to Israel. These be the gods which brought you up out of Egypt. And they basically say, hey, tomorrow's going to be a feast day. We're going to worship these gods. That day comes. They're feasting. Now look. Look about verse 25. And now it's come to God's attention. They've done this. He's become angry. He's told Moses, get out of the way. I'm going to destroy these people. I'm going to make a new nation out of you. And Moses, being the man that he is, also having being tested, says, whoa, God, wait. Think before you do this. If you destroy these people, what are your enemies going to think? They're going to think that you brought these people up, that you brought them out of Egypt, that you did all the great works in Egypt, just so you could bring them out into the middle of nowhere and destroy them. And God says, okay, because of what you have said, because of my name, I will not destroy them. Moses comes back down. And you see that Joshua is with him because at one point you see that it says that Joshua thought that there was war in the camp. And Moses says, well, no, it's not that. Verse 25, Exodus 32, 25. And when Moses saw that the people were naked, for Aaron had made them naked unto their shame among their enemies. Why would the people be naked? When did they get naked? If you look a bit earlier in the chapter, it'll say that they got up to play. They got up to play. When it talks about them getting up to play, they're not just getting up to basically just dance and jump up and down and be all happy because they have a god to worship. No, they were getting up to worship the gods like they had been taught to worship gods in Egypt. And when you look at it, many of the gods back then, many fertility goddesses or fertility gods, many gods, one of the ways they were worshipped was by committing fornication. In certain times it was committing adultery. If they had priests or priestesses, certain of the priests or priestesses would be prostitutes. When you look at the Greek goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love, her priests and priestesses, that's what they were. That's why they were naked, is because they had been worshiping their god. And this is when the cycle started. This is how Balaam knew to tell Balak, look, if you get them to sleep with your daughters, you're going to get them destroyed by God anyways. You're going to get God to curse them anyways. Because that is how the gods were worshipped back then. So then you can go to Judges chapter 2, and then about verse 10, a new generation comes up knowing not God. They restart the cycle, and then from that point on, you see that cycle just keep turning. You see that wheel keep on turning. But then, one thing I think that we make a mistake of is that during the king's times, during the kings, is that they stopped worshiping God. We think that they were worshiping all these other gods and that they weren't worshiping God. Go to Isaiah 58 with me. Go to Isaiah 58. If you have little headers in your Bible, although those are not inspired, mine says genuine fasting. In school, we were basically taught that this was Isaiah's chapter on hypocrisy. Because when you read through it and when you read through all of Isaiah, you really see that they were still worshiping God, but they were worshiping Him like they worshiped their other gods. They weren't worshiping Him His prescribed way. They were sitting there and they're like, well, you know what? We need to worship God. He is a God. Let's worship Him. Oh, we'll just do it this way. Oh, well, we're not going to give Him the best. We're going to give Him the leftover. Just start in verse 1. Cry aloud, spare not, lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me daily, and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness, and forsook not the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinance of justice. They take delight in approaching to God. Right off, Isaiah says, God says through Isaiah, you guys wanted to worship me. You want to know my ways. You want to worship me. You want to have my blessings. But you want to have my blessings and you want to get them your way. You want to do things your way and you want to get the good stuff. Kind of how it is today. People want the blessing of salvation, but they want to get to it their way. They want God to save them in the end times. They want Him to be there for them when they want Him, but then they want to put Him up on the shelf until they need Him. They don't want to have to give themselves to Him. That's exactly what Israel is doing. That's what Israel, Judah, that's what they were doing in Isaiah 58. Is they were worshiping Him, they were wanting the good stuff from Him, and then they were just wanting to put Him up on that shelf. That is part of the reason why after a while, God said, you know what? I am done. He said, I am a very patient God. I am a very long-suffering God. But just as we read of with the Amalekites in Abraham's time, they were there and God says, their iniquity is not yet full. And then you come into the time of Moses and they fight Amalek and they completely destroy Amalek. God finally says, your iniquity is full. I've had it. Now I am going to punish you. And he didn't just choose to do this any old way, any old day. Think about the cycle in Judges. How does it normally go? They were worshiping God. They were doing what they were supposed to under Joshua. And under the elders that followed after him. And then the new generation came and they started leaving God. They finally got so far away from God that God punished them. And what did they do after God punished them? They came back. Go with me to Amos chapter 4. Go with me to Amos chapter 4. If you can't see how this is making sense yet, I'm about to make it all make sense, I promise. Go to Amos chapter 4. If someone wouldn't mind, start at Amos chapter 4, verse 6, and just keep reading. Amos chapter 4 and verse 6. You can stop right there. Thank you. What has God basically just told, or just had Amos tell Israel here? He's basically told them, look, I allowed all of these things to happen to you. You could say boldly tells them, I let you starve. I allowed you to starve. I allowed you to go into a drought and to go into a famine. He goes on and he says, I did all of these things. I killed your young men. I had all of these horrible things come upon you. And he's like, and why did I do it? Because in the past, when evil things happen to you, you return to me. But what does he say here? He says, I did all of this thinking, hoping that you would return to me, that you would finally see the error of your ways and say, God, look, we see what we've done. We are fools. We need you. We want you to help us. He says that this is why he did this, and he says what? But ye would not. He says, you had done this in the past. I was hoping this would get you to do it here, but you didn't. And what does he say is the outcome of that? Because you would not return to me, because you would not return to worshiping me in my prescribed way, because you would not give me what you had once given me, you're done. You are going to go into captivity. You are going to have your freedom taken away. He had says, I gave you this land and I gave it to you conditionally. I have met my condition of giving you the land. However, you have not met your conditions. And because of that, I'm going to take this land and you're going to deal with it. And I mean, it's not that he just put them into captivity. He literally said, look, I'm leaving you and I'm not coming back. He's like, I am done with you. You can go to Ezekiel chapter 10, and there Ezekiel records the presence of the Lord, the glory of the Lord, literally leaving the temple. And the importance of that is that the temple was put there for God to be among his people. That was there so that they were thinking of him and that he had a place that was literally among them. Him leaving it means that he's gone, never to return. Now that's what he wanted them to think. When you read through Isaiah, when you read through the prophets, you see that God did have a plan of returning them, that they were only going to be punished for a certain amount of time, and that there would be a remnant that would return, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. But he was literally telling them, look, you have done so much, you have pushed me to my limit. Until everything has been made right, I am done with you. I am done with you. And I think it's safe to say that, what can we learn from the lessons of Judah and Israel as a country? I think we're fastly approaching that point to where we're going to see, in one shape or form, God, and I'm going to air quote it, God leaving the temple. God finally telling America, I'm done with you. And allowing us to be overtaken. Whether that is coming shortly, whether that's 100 years, I don't know. But we can look at Israel, we can look at Judah, we can look at every other nation and see America in it. So I just wanted to show us, or show more reasons why they did go into captivity, why God allowed that to happen, and show that they brought it on themselves. God didn't just do it because he wanted to. He had his reasons. He warned them, just like he warned the other nations. They didn't listen, so like a parent, he chastised his child. So go ahead and go back to Ezra now. Go ahead and go back to Ezra. So, all of this is basically looking at the Old Testament book by book and seeing redemption. We can look at Ezra as the remnant returns. We see that they have been in captivity. We see that they are going to be allowed to return home. They're going to go back to the land that they had been promised. They are going to be given the chance to become, or to, I guess you could say, remain God's people if they remain faithful. We can read the rest of the Bible and see that they did not remain faithful, and that God ultimately told them that they were no longer His chosen people, and that He made Himself a new chosen people. But this begins the third and final historical period of the historical books of the Old Testament. If you want to look at it, it's broken down in between Joshua and Judges and Ruth. That's about 364 years. That goes from about 1407 to 1443. And then you have Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. Basically, that's the kingdom era where they were literally the kingdom of Israel and then the kingdoms of Judah and Israel. That spans about 1043 to 586, 457 years. And then you have the period of restoration from 586 to 432. 586 is the actual year where they started returning back. And that itself is about 154 years, and that's what we read in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. That is when they are returning, you could say, to start anew, to have their second chance at remaining God's people. It was Judah and Israel. The thing we have to understand about that, and that I think that is one thing that plays a lot into premillennialism, is that there are certain people that they believe that Israel, that there are 10 lost tribes, and that it is those tribes that are going to be the ones that come back to present day Israel, and that they never received the promise of land. We can look, of course, as we said, at I believe it's Joshua chapter 21, where it says that God gave them all the land that He had promised them. But one thing that people really forget or don't think about is who took the nation of Israel? The Assyrians did. Who overthrew the Assyrian army or the Assyrian nation? Babylon. So if Assyria was overtaken by Babylon, all of their slaves, all of their inhabitants would then become Babylonian. And so then any Israelites that were with the Assyrians would have become Babylonians, Babylonian slaves. So when it talks of the remnant, it is the remnant of anyone that wanted to return back from the nations of Israel and Judah. But that is a very good question. Thank you. So it is the remnant of any of God's people that wanted to return back. There were no 10 lost tribes. And I mean, that's the way it was put to me in school, is that, there were the 10 lost tribes. So it's anyone, as it says in the very first verses of Ezra chapter 1, anyone that wanted to return of God's children. That is the remnant that returns. If you want a, like, quick breakdown, 586, Babylon carries Israel into captivity. 539, Babylon fell to Cyrus. 536, the decree of Cyrus. You jump down. 520, there's Haggai and Zechariah stirring up the people to rebuild the temple. You look at about 516, the reconstruction of the temple is completed. That's Ezra 6. Ahasuerus is defeated at Thermopylae and Salamis. And that's that point that I was talking about that comes in between Esther chapter 1 and Esther chapter 2. That kind of humbles King Ahasuerus. Secular history knows him as King Artaxerxes. Is that he got into the battle with the Grecians, with Alexander the Great. He lost to them. He comes back a humbled man. 458, Ezra returns back from Jerusalem. 457, the last event in the book of Ezra occurred in the 8th year of Artaxerxes. Year 444, Nehemiah returns to build the walls of Jerusalem. just some key people. There's the decree of Cyrus. That's basically one of the major things in Ezra is the decree, is that it was foretold that he would allow the people to come back. He made that decree. They went back to do what God had wanted them to. Many people might think that Ezra is the leader of the people coming back, but when you look at it, Zerubbabel was the leader of the first returning Israelites. Zerubbabel was. There's the high priest Jeshua, encouragers, or Haggai and Zechariah, and of course they are minor prophets that they wrote, and they were encouraging, like Nehemiah, for the Israelites to restore Jerusalem, to restore it so that they would have protection, to restore it to what it had been. There's a second expedition, that's chapter 7 through 10. What we can really learn from Ezra is that the prophecies of Isaiah were fulfilled. And there are a bunch of them in Israel, are a bunch of prophecies in Isaiah, where he tells them that they are going to be returned. When you look at the book of Isaiah, you kind of see a back and forth. And by that I mean that Isaiah will sit there and he will just rain fire and brimstone down on Israel and tell them, look, God is going to destroy you. God is going to throw you away. God is done with you. And then after all of this, basically wearing them down and telling them, look, if you don't get right, God is going to destroy you. He says, but God will destroy you, but there will be a remnant that he'll allow to return. And then he says, look, this is bleak, but there is still the silver lining to come. There are, best way I can put it is there are bukus and bukus of prophecies inside not only Isaiah, but inside of Ezekiel, inside of Jeremiah, where God is telling them, look, I'm going to destroy you because that's what you've brought me to, but I'm not going to completely destroy you. I'm going to leave a remnant of my people to come back to the land. And really, that's what you could say Ezekiel 37 is about. The dry bones, they're coming back, and God asks him, what is this? And he's talking with God, and then there's the two sticks, and they come together as one, that the remnant of Israel, the remnant of Judah, coming back together, the remnant that was to come back. That Israel, or that God's people, were not completely destroyed, that there was some left that would return. Yeah. That is when it would be really good to have a chronological Bible. Is if you have a chronological Bible, it really has everything in chronological time of when it was written. And when you look at the major and the minor prophets, although they come after Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther, they were writing during the kingdoms. So I mean, it's like if you look at Isaiah and you look at Micah. They wrote around the same time because they both basically have word for word one prophecy. If you look at Isaiah chapter 2 verses 2 and 3 and then you were to look at Micah chapter 4 verses 1 and following, you see word for word a prophecy that is really alluding to the church. So it really is broken up in an odd way, but when you think of it, you have to think of it that Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther are the end of the history. And then although the prophets come after them, the prophets were writing before them. And I mean, it's like Haggai and Zechariah. They were writing around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. So that's the best way I can put it. I hope that kind of helps you. Okay. Are there any other questions up to this point? I know I hadn't really asked, and I normally like to ask. I guess I should ask, like, Raphael, am I making sense? I haven't confused you guys. Okay. Next, notice the tie with the past. Ezra, a scribe and a priest, descended from Hilkiah, the high priest of the time of Josiah. So Ezra is a priest, and it is basically his job to deal with reminding this new generation of Israelites of what happened in the past. It is his duty as a priest and as a scribe to do what Moses had done before him, what the prophets had done before him. So he's basically tying it back to the past. He's teaching this new generation as Moses had done with the generation that was going to be going into the land, and then as Joshua had done with the land, with those that were in the land as he was dying. Notice the tie with the future. Zerubbabel is the son of Shealtiel, an ancestor of Jesus, Matthew 1, 12 and 13. So you have one man that's looking backwards and one man that's looking forwards. The remnant returns home and rebuilds the house of God under the leadership of Zerubbabel. The remnant restores the worship of God under the leadership of Ezra. And that's not just the hypocritical worship of Isaiah 58. That is the true worship that is taught, the, you could say, that we're told to have in John chapter 4, verses 23 and 24. They're worshiping in spirit and in truth. They're worshiping in the prescribed way for the prescribed reason. So that's Ezra. That's what we can learn from it, is that God fulfills his prophecies, that God never truly left the Israelites. He's not going to leave us. And that he wants true worship. He's going to always have someone there to help us remember why he's given us reasons to worship him and given us exact ways to worship him. So Ezra is basically showing us the remnant returning to the land. Nehemiah's job was the remnant rebuilding. Nehemiah basically is focusing on rebuilding the wall. They are sitting there. He comes. There's no wall. They could be attacked at any time. He comes in and he helps them rebuild the wall. In 2 Kings, Israel and Judah are taken captive. Ezra, we see the return of the redeemed remnant. Now in Nehemiah, we see the remnant rebuilding. Nehemiah was a restorer. His lesson is a lesson about restoration. And even today, restoration is still important to us. Not only because God has restored us from what we once were, but because we need to keep on making sure that his church that he restored stays in a state of restoration, if that makes sense. When we look at Nehemiah, he was a man of many talents. He was a cupbearer for the king, and that's a job that not many people would want to have, because the man that was the cupbearer, he was the man that he would basically test the food, he would test the drinks, make sure that there was no poison in it. And I mean, he was very close to the king, because early on in Nehemiah, he's sitting there and he looks down, he looks very sullen faced, and the king asks him, is something wrong? What's wrong? And Nehemiah basically explains to him, well, my people are returning home, and I want to go with them for a while. I want to be there with them. I want to help them. I want to take care of them. And the king asks, well, how long are you going to be gone? Nehemiah gives him a certain time, and then after that he comes back, and then he'll make another trip back, kind of like Ezra did. When we look at Nehemiah, we see that restoration